This is More in the Morning on News Talk 1010 Toronto.
7:06 is the time. Look at that. Sun's come up. I shouldn't be so amazed at the sun coming up, except that when you do this show in particular, and I get it, a lot of you work really early hours as well, so you're subject to this. I become very, very sensitive about what time of day the sun comes up. And of course, in the summer, when we go on the air, boom, it's already beautifully sunny outside. As a matter of fact, it's sometimes sunny for the drive in. But it feels good as we draw toward the end of February. And maybe this is a very pointy-headed thing to ponder, but I think Paul Delaney, our astronomer, is still on a trip, Joe Cristiano. I'd love to know, okay, if we have a day that is added on, a leap day that is added on every 4 years, how out of sync are some things right now as we draw toward Friday? Because it is Friday, the leap day, is it not?
Thursday.
Is it Thursday?
And I've already given this topic to Dan Riskin because I figured this would be a good topic for him for our Test Tube Thursday.
So I'm not like some kid thinking, what was the world like before the world was here? Okay, so it'll be interesting to find out how out of sync things are and whether or not that factors into all kinds of, you know, the people who look at the stars have to factor in the fact that there's this sort of drifting time such that we got a day that we've got to drop in order to get back on the right clock. Anyway, the other thing, and we talked about this yesterday, so I'll breeze through it, but I'm always mindful of the fact that people come and go. So sometimes I'll say something at 6 a.m. that nobody who tuned in at 7 ever heard. But apparently it's lore reaching back to the year 500, where women can propose to men on leap day. And I appreciate times have kind of changed, so it's not as outrageous a thought as it used to be. But the 29th. Actually, you better watch out, Joe Cristiano.
I know, but I went and researched this after you mentioned it yesterday.
Okay.
And if a man turns down a woman on February 29th, he has to give her 12 pairs of gloves to hide the shame of her not wearing the engagement ring.
12 pairs of gloves. Okay.
Good thing Nordstrom shut down.
Well, I guess, you know, I mean, almost by default then, I have a feeling Brie may propose on the 29th because at least she gets the gloves. Wow. That is a great bit of trivia. Tuck that away, Nick Marano. That
yep.
is not totally useless information. That is the kind of thing that's like, really? I like that. 7:09, maybe I'll propose. 7:09 is the time. And we'll find out at 7:45 on Free For All Round 1 what our panelists think of the bump in the cost of throwing the FIFA World Cup here in Toronto. But Olivia Chow still seems to be on board. I guess she has to be. I mean, you can't really sort of turn on a marquee event that's happening in your city once you were in favor of it. Throwing number 22, this is Olivia Chow. Now, very quickly, just to set this up, we found out yesterday, we thought the city was going to be on the hook for $300 million to stage 5 games. Now we've got 6, and apparently, owing to that and inflation, we're now on the hook for $380 million.
It's important that we are transparent, that we are realistic, and at the time, no one anticipated the rate of inflation of today. I ensured, I made sure that that was factored in what's been made public today. There is a budget, and I will make sure the game is hosted in the most responsibly but exciting way.
Bob Richardson, who you hear quite frequently here on News Talk 1010, is going to join us at 8:05 this morning because he's pretty close to the soccer game, I guess we could say. He's an advisor to FIFA World Cup 2026 and a former member of the Canada Soccer Board of Directors. And I'm glad he's going to join us because he can make the case. I've already weighed in on this. I'll wait for the pundits to weigh in on it. I'm pretty sure Jerry is not enthusiastic about even the first $300, let alone $380 million. But at the same time, I look at the net benefits, which it could end up being, it's kind of like an Italian wedding. You know, dad throws the wedding, everybody brings money. Basically, it's the exact same amount of money that the wedding cost, but the kids get the money and then they can spend it on a house. And so, yeah, the city's going to be out $380 million, but a lot of hotels, restaurants, shopping enterprises, and various other things, and all the temporary hires, the net-net, it's going to be about the same amount of money that gets injected into the economy. Great news as concerns traffic. And I have to say, I mean, I don't know who wrote this copy. I think this article comes from blog TO, but it is somewhat florid. In a bustling city where every second counts, it's sort of like it was written by Fraser Crane. Toronto finds itself grappling with a persistent issue that brings its streets to a standstill. Drivers who block the box, causing gridlock and endangering pedestrians and cyclists, are at the heart of a growing concern. The city's latest proposal to hike fines significantly from a mere $90 to a hefty $450 or even $500 in sensitive areas aims to steer clear of congestion and enhance safety. But the road to implement these steeper penalties is fraught with bureaucratic hurdles, needing a nod from Ontario's Attorney General and a judicial green light. And then it goes on, and actually the real florid stuff. And I wrote down the name of the person who wrote it. It's Sakshi Kandaloa. At the intersection of necessity and frustration, Toronto's downtown streets witness a daily ballet of vehicles, pedestrians, and cyclists. The choreography, however, is disrupted by vehicles blocking the box, creating a domino effect of congestion and danger. With a current fine of 90 seen as insufficient to deter this behavior, city officials are pushing for a substantial increase. The proposal aiming for fines of $450 for general offenses, $500 in community safety zones, seeks to prioritize safety and fluidity on the streets. Okay. So, I mean, you know, blocking the box. I actually had to explain it to somebody this morning because they didn't know what the box was, but it's getting into an intersection and then you don't get through the intersection. So you're standing in the intersection and the light changes and the traffic that would be going through the intersection can't because you're sitting there. And so the important thing here, not only is the fine, but it's going to be enforcement, right? Because humans will have to do this. Unless they change the rules, it's not going to be good enough for a traffic cam to capture you doing this. And apparently, you have to, unlike a lot of other offenses, you do not assess the penalty against the car. It is assessed against the driver. So I guess these new wardens or whatever we're calling them are going to inherit the power to point at you, tell you to pull over, issue a ticket. More drama at the One development. This is an 85-story behemoth, as it's described here, and it is a behemoth. It's a gigantic building. It's mixed use, and it's on the corner of Yonge and Bloor. It's on the west-south corner, and it's been the object of court suits and stop work orders and all kinds of things. And now, one of the principal developers, Sam Mizrahi, is out. And I don't know who recorded him, but apparently he was in a meeting with staff yesterday. And somebody recorded the meeting and then leaked details of it. But at one point he said, "We just have a difference of opinion on how to build this building. I like to build stuff that's the top quality and the best there is. They want to take it in a different direction." There's more than $1 billion involved here. As of last October, the project was $1.6 billion in debt. It was supposed to be done by 2022, and they've only poured about 40 of the 85 stories. So it is a complete and utter mess. And one of the arguments, incidentally, for why there is a public interest in development, this is a prime piece of real estate that is, you know, an important urban corner. It doesn't belong to everybody, but the people have an interest in what is built there and if it gets built badly or wrong. The Online Harms Act was tabled yesterday in Ottawa, and this is an effort to basically create some guardrails and also have certain content taken off of the web. It's complicated stuff, though, and it may be a little overly ambitious, and it may be a little bit overly hopeful in terms of the amount of control a government can have over something that is essentially unregulated and international. Michael Geist, a University of Ottawa professor and the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law, is our guest this morning on this proposed legislation. Nice to have you, Professor.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
What's your first takeaway from what Ottawa has introduced here?
Yeah, I must admit it was more positive than I had expected, on a couple of grounds. First, I think the government's track record when it's come to internet regulation has been not particularly impressive. I thought both the streaming bill and the news bill were enormously problematic. And some of the initial indications several years ago when they first launched a consultation on this raised a lot of red flags and faced almost universal opposition. And so they did go back to the drawing board and engaged in a wide range of consultations, and at least on the core part of the legislation, the part dealing with the role that platforms will have and how to deal with some of those issues and making it more targeted, focused on specific harms, I think they've done a far better job than they did before. I think there are some concerns around how this is going to be enforced. I think there's concerns about some of the Criminal Code and Human Rights Act provisions that I think many are fearing may overstep. So there is certainly some areas that need further study and may need some amendment. But at the same time, it's definitely a better starting point than we might have otherwise expected.
Now, there are various categories that they're going after, categories of content, and in some cases, they have very little to do with each other. So maybe we need to sort them out. One would be, what they call revenge porn or child pornography or somebody being sextorted, as they call it. And what measures are they taking there?
Well, what's interesting about this bill is that for the most part, with a couple of exceptions, and one of them is intimate images that are communicated without consent. For the most part, they're not trying to get content-specific provisions. There are a couple of areas or kinds of content where they say this sort of content needs to come down within 24 hours, and that would be one of them, so that they have established a set of rules that says for this kind of content, where it is reported to a platform, you've got to take action quickly, and then they've spelled out a full appellate process and review process, but they say the immediate harm is such that it needs to come down. For most of the rest of the content, if we're talking about fomenting hatred or inciting violence or violent extremism or terrorism or children harm to content that could induce a child to harm themselves or bullying, there are seven in total. Really, the framing is to say that platforms have to act responsibly. They've got a duty to act responsibly, and they try to spell out some of the things that might include things like ensuring that people can flag content where there's a particular concern, that they've got a digital safety plan that's in place, that they try to de-emphasize some of those kinds of harms. And so they're not targeting particular kinds of content per se, as opposed to essentially focusing on what the internet platforms ought to be doing.
Okay, so this is your speciality, and you're generally impressed with their effort.
Well, I'm, given where we started in terms of the consultation earlier, where there was things like website blocking and automated reporting to law enforcement, there was a lot of concerns about what the government had in mind. And I have to say that it genuinely feels like this may be the first internet regulation bill from this government that's been more focused on policy rather than implementing the demands of lobby groups or settling scores with big tech. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't room for improvement. I think there are real concerns about the creation of a new digital safety commission. I mean, there needs to be someone that enforces this, but they've been given massive new powers, and I'm not sure that there's the appropriate oversight and checks and balances there. And then even within things like the Human Rights Commission, the fact that we are going to see just potentially an influx of complaints arising out of that legislation, or even the possibility in the Criminal Code of life in prison in some circumstances, I think that for those sorts of provisions, we need to think both what the actual implications will be and whether or not these are realistic sorts of provisions.
Thanks for this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Michael Geist is a professor at the University of Ottawa. So, speaking of regulations and change, Toronto's new single-use takeaway item bylaw comes into effect on Friday. How's this going to affect you? Markedly, actually. Starting on Friday, if you want utensils, you'll have to ask for them. If you want a bag, you'll have to ask for it. And actually, if you want a napkin, you're going to have to ask for that. So I realize some people are going to say, oh, great, it's just, how can we formalize and make this a more unpleasant experience? But it's quite frequent. You know, like I'll go to McDonald's. I have a weakness for chicken McNuggets. I'll get a box of six. I don't need that in a bag. I can carry it out in my hand. So, you know, they'll put it on the counter, I guess. And unless I say I'd like a bag, or unless they ask and I'll say no, then that's fine. One less bag consumed. And then there are times where I'll go to a fast food joint on Yonge Street around the corner from the house, but I'll go home and eat it at the house. In which case, I don't need the plastic utensils. Those are just going to end up in the recycling bin, unused. So I don't know that it's necessarily that much of a threat to our daily comings and goings. Although, Joe, you were wondering if perhaps you go in and you ask for 5 McHappy Meals, they're just going to splay them out on the counter and expect you to juggle them back to the car.
No, but I'm waiting for the detour of just each other staring at the, you know, the cashier and just waiting for someone to say, so can I get a bag?
Yeah, but I don't think it's like a Harry Potter spell. You know, I don't think they're going to stand there saying, or it's not going to be like Breaking Bad. Say my name. Say my name. Can I have a plastic bag, please? Thank you.
I would love that.
Speaking of bad corporate communications, Kellogg's CEO is getting quite the backlash because he did an interview on CNBC. And he said, you know, times are tough. So people who can't afford their food, why don't they eat cereal for dinner? It's a great thing to do. And a lot of people are saying, shouldn't you be a little bit more worried about living in a society where people can't afford dinner as opposed to trying to push your breakfast product for dinner? If you're wondering, Kellogg makes Frosted Flakes, Fruit Loops, Corn Flakes, Raisin Bran, and various others. And what was his expression? Give chicken the night off. Although apparently that's been an ad campaign for a while. But it's a very Marie Antoinette moment. And I virtually guarantee this shows up on Touchdowns and Fumbles on Jerry's show with Bob Reed on Friday. And here's another wonderful debatable that we have put on the agenda. Can't always promise we're going to get to every topic, but I like to, as I say, set the table before the roundtable so you can arrive at your own conclusions before the pundits even arrive. But apparently, this is a working document. The province of British Columbia will instruct its residents not to refer to themselves as British Columbians because that is offensive. It excludes Indigenous people who may not identify it, they say. And then it may also upset newcomers. So the correct term now is going to be people living in BC, kind of like people who are pregnant and all these new expressions. Although, you know what? A lot of phraseology has changed. I used to say an autistic person, and then I would hear from the parents of children with autism who would say, please say children with autism. And that is perfectly reasonable. You're not defined head to toe by being on the spectrum. So sometimes these things are not unreasonable. But you know, when it comes to inclusion and Indigenous peoples and stuff like that, because this British Columbian business is about Indigenous peoples for the most part, all I can tell you is the Indigenous people I know, like here, we are very strictly, the style guide says, only say Indigenous. And then I'll be talking with one of our Indigenous contributors, and they'll say Indian, Native, First Nations, Aboriginal. They'll use all those words.
You're listening to More in the Morning on News Talk 1010, Toronto.
This ain't Texas. Oh. Ain't no hold 'em. Hey. So lay your cards down, 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 down. So pocket legs.
7:35 is the time. And that is the sound of the number one tune on the Billboard Global 200. Beyonce singing Texas Hold'em. She's kind of gone from 0 to 100. In a matter of days, because she only revealed at the Grammy Awards that she was coming out with a country album. Then this single dropped. People decided they liked it. And now there it is, number one on the Global 200. We're joined by Ian Howcroft, CEO of Skills Ontario, to talk about the trades. Many times we've done open line about the trades and the reluctance that some people have to get into it, or the joy that they have found getting into the trades, sometimes starting their own company, having people who answer to them, and they're making executive salaries. Ian Howcroft, it's good to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, John. I'm very happy to be here.
Okay. And if I remember from the press release, like this is in honor of like Trade Day or something like that?
Well, we're getting ready for our big competition. So it's in May. So we're trying to do everything we can to promote the opportunities and skill trades and technologies. So we're trying to make sure people are aware of this. And on the positive side, I'm really pleased to say that I think there's a real change in the way people are viewing the trades. I think we're actually having some success in dealing with the negative stigma that many people used to have about that. Still a long way to go, but I'm starting to see a lot more positive comments about the trades. And I think parents are starting to recognize that, hey, we should be encouraging our children to explore the trades and find out if it's right for them. So I think there's a lot of positives going on right now. And have to recognize and give some credit to the Ontario government that's shown some real leadership and has made some significant investments into dealing with the stigma, into creating more skilled trades opportunities for young people. And we're very pleased to be a partner in moving this forward. We're celebrating our 35th anniversary this year, so it's a long-standing issue. But I think the first time in 35 years, we're starting to see some real pickup on the image that skilled trades people have in the province of Ontario.
So you've got a list with you of the top five trade skills that are going to be most in demand in the coming years. What are they?
Well, it depends on what sector you're looking at, but we're all looking now at the challenges around the housing crisis, and that's a multifaceted issue that we all have to deal with. But right now, we don't even have the skilled trades people to deal with that. So if you're looking at construction, we're looking for carpenters, we're looking for electricians, we're looking for elevator repair people. You know, they need them to construct condos, but also if you've been in a building with an elevator out of service, it can take a long time to get an elevator repair person. Huge shortage in those areas, you know, the HVAC. So the construction has a whole lot of need for the skilled trades, welders and boilermakers. When you're looking at the manufacturing sector, you're looking at machinists and millwrights. The service sector, you're looking at chefs. I mean, the service sector was probably the most challenged, most devastated by the pandemic. So they lost an awful lot of their employees. So they're trying to rebuild a workplace and workforce that was already under a great deal of pressure. I heard you talking with Tom, and we're getting ready for our competition. We have 77 discrete contests at the Skills Ontario competition, including one in fashion design. As I said, there's 144 skilled trades in Ontario. So what we want people to do is to get out there, open your eyes, open your minds, and explore. We have try-a-trade opportunities to get young people to explore and have that experiential opportunity to see what might be right for them. There's in our view, there's no bad career path, but if you're not even aware of what a skilled trade career could be, we have to do a better job of making sure young people are aware of that. So we go into the schools, we make sure young people are aware of some of these opportunities. The Ministry of Education announced that there's going to be a requirement that all students, I think it's grade 10, have to take a technology-related course. So a lot of positive moves, a lot of positive investments, and I have to say a lot of positive success that we're having. But as I say, and we all see, there's still a long way to go.
Thanks a lot for this. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Ian Howcroft, CEO of Skills Ontario. He makes a good case, and we didn't even get into compensation, but a lot of these jobs are unionized, and a lot of them, you can become an entrepreneur. And it's funny, because just while talking, I get an email from the electrician who was at the house this week, closing the file effectively. But he seems like a very happy guy, and he's very good at his job. On round one, Jerry Agar is here, and he's yours from 10 to noon every Monday to Friday. Deb Hutton, former advisor to two premiers. Scott Reed, CTV political commentator and former advisor to Prime Minister Paul Martin. Good to have you all. Let's start with the money item, and that would be now we're at $380 million for FIFA. One of the reasons it's gone up, apparently, is inflation. The other is we planned for five games. We're going to end up with six. If memory serves, Jerry, you were never a fan to begin with.
Nope. How much did we have to bribe Taylor Swift to put on six concerts here in Toronto? Zero. How about the WWE or any of these other big concerts and organizations that come and bring an audience and bring economic development to the city? FIFA is a corrupt organization. I would like to know, actually, I'll ask Bob Richardson because he's involved in this. He'll be joining me at 11 o'clock. How much do we have to bribe the officials to get this stuff?
Deb Hutton, your thoughts?
Well, John, you and I did this as a topic on our Monday segment, Getting It Right, a long time ago. And I said, Olivia Chow could be amazing for a lot of people if she brought this thing in on whatever the new budget is. And my recommendation to her, which stands today, is get somebody from the private sector who understands government and is supportive of this to put their arms around it, be the whatever you want to call it, the FIFA czar, and not only stay on budget and on time, but bring in private sector dollars. Get sponsorships. We're already into this. I understand Jerry's point fully, but we're into this. And this notion that, well, the way the city will deal with it is to ask another layer of government to pay for it, just means we're all on the hook. Doesn't matter which pocket it comes out of. Private sector involvement and a single individual, a John Tory-esque person, maybe John Tory, I don't care who it is, whose sole responsibility is keeping their thumb on any additional costs.
Scott Reed, the estimate is that it'll bring in as much as we spend on it, except, of course, we're still out of pocket at the City of Toronto. But it's kind of like an Italian wedding.
I guess. It's kind of like an Italian wedding. What, like you Luca throw Brazzi the party. Sitting in the corner going, I want to thank you for having me here on the day of your daughter's wedding.
Everybody in an Italian wedding is expected to pay their share of the
kidding.
Freight.
The older ladies bring their tinfoil and take the food home.
Do they really?
Yeah. I guess I'm an older lady.
But they get the bombonieri.
Breaking news here for you. It's not going to stop at 380. It's going to rise again. It isn't just inflation and the fact that we have an extra game. It's that these things, and to Jerry's point, these things, particularly FIFA, always swell. The costs always swell. And bringing in a private sector czar, I'm sorry, but that isn't going to help either, because FIFA has such strong and strict rules with respect to partnerships and sponsorships. All that stuff is regulated at the meta level. And so, it is what it is, man, but it's not a great look for the city. And this was literally part and parcel of saying we're going to go in for this, is that you would not have control over the cost. We won't. This thing is going to swell, and it's going to be what it is, and people will make all these extraordinary and convoluted arguments about, well, we did an econometric examination, and what we found was that by 3-1, the money came back to the city. Okay, whatever. And I don't hate football, soccer, whatever you want to call it. I'm just saying, you're never going to come out ahead, and the bill is always going to be bigger than promised.
Yeah, I could find lots of articles this morning that said, oh, it's going to bring in this much, and estimates are it'll be this much value to the city. Here's what I couldn't find. The actual economic study, I want to read it. I want to see how they say that this will happen, because this is the kind of thing I think they will do. When it's all over, they will say, well, look, we had this many hotel rooms booked, and the tax came off of that. Those hotels would be 80% booked anyway, based on history. So you can't count at least 80% of that as economic development. It's going to be a big boondoggle, and they will lie to you about how much benefit came in.
Toronto drivers could face hefty fines for blocking the box, driving into an intersection before you know that you're going to get to the other side and then ending up stuck in it and cross traffic can't get through. Scott Reed, this is one of those things that drives most motorists out of their minds. And if we can find a way to put a lid on it, it would speed things up in the downtown.
Frontier justice is my answer. I don't think the fine will do the trick. These people that drive in the middle of the intersection they have no geometrical brain whatsoever. They can't foresee that they're going to be trapped there. They don't care about everybody else. It's only about them. There's nothing that drives me more bananas than when this occurs and I'm sitting behind that person. It's galling. And, I'm normally leave those fines. Get off my ass, all you parking people. But in this case, I say slam them as hard as possible.
$260 is not enough?
Not enough.
Okay.
Not enough.
That's the proposed amount.
I think they should take their windows out of their car. That's my solution. You have to drive around for the rest of the winter with no windows. Help yourself to that. I hope it's nice and frosty for you. Then maybe you'll learn your lesson.
Although, Deb Hutton, it is vexing when somebody does this, but it is somewhat delicious to look at the face of somebody who's blocking the box, because they usually have their head bowed in shame.
I don't care, because not always. When we hang up today at 8 o'clock, I will walk my daughter to school as I do every day. And it's not the downtown core, it's Yonge and Lawrence. And every day when we cross at the cross light just north of Lawrence on Yonge, someone, even as the light is turning red, will enter the intersection and block my 9-year-old from walking across the crosswalk. It is everywhere, and it is not by accident. And people who do that when the light turns red and see the two of us standing on the curb along with other little kids know damn well what they're doing. I am with Scott. I'm not so big on the windows being taken out for winter, but 260 is not nearly enough. And if you get that pain time and time again, maybe you'll stop the behavior.
I think the 260 is not enough, and neither is taking out the windows. I mean, it's just the place that I encounter this, if I go home later in the afternoon, is Front and Spadina. I mean, I think there needs to be a cop there, actually, during rush hour to direct the traffic, because the lights aren't getting it done. People just, it's they don't, the thing you talked about, Scott, the option that you gave, it's they don't give a damn about everybody else. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And the fine they're looking at, actually, I went back into the coverage. It's currently $90. They're looking at $450 or even $500. Is that and the windows good enough?
The windows is a necessary part. I just want to add to Jerry's specific example of driving at Front and Spadina. I'd rather try to drive through the desert in Mad Max Fury Road. Like, it is just, that is the worst place in the entire city. And all that Bananarama with the transit thing there, and you find yourself in the tunnel, and suddenly you can't get your car out. And you've, increasingly, I just don't want to bring my car south of Bloor.
Mayors are concerned, and not just the mayor of Toronto, mayors all over Ontario are concerned Justin Trudeau is not actually going to deliver long-term infrastructure money in the 2024 budget. That would be quite the disappointment, Deb.
Yeah, but I mean, is anybody surprised? I mean, we also had an environment minister, no matter how much he backtracked or redefined his comment, who said, we're not going to be doing big infrastructure roads anymore. That's not what we're about. I don't think they've actually ponied up. If they're not about roads and they should be about transit, which was his point, I don't think they've actually ponied up for the four agreed by all three level projects of transit here in the GTA. Like, they spend like drunken sailors, to use a very old phrase. I feel now old having said that, but they do. And then they don't spend on a lot of really important, lasting things.
Well, the
and
sailors.
It's ridiculous.
The sailors, by the way, Deb, spend their own money.
Okay.
There you go, Jerry, an even older reference.
Wow, all we need is a park bench.
And some pigeons.
Okay. We can't afford it.
Scott Reed, your thoughts.
Well, let's just take one step back. First of all, we'll see what they put in the budget. If they don't put it in the budget, they'll have some sort of framework going for the, you know, but they're spending at historic levels on infrastructure, and that's not a defense of them. What I'm saying is, like, people sit around and bitch and moan about how this government is out of control spending, except for all the things that they want the government to spend on. So they're not spending enough on housing, they're not spending enough on infrastructure, they're not spending enough on mental health, they're not spending enough on healthcare, and on and on and on it goes. All I'm saying is, lots of fun being in office when everybody says, quit spending except for the thing that 2% for NATO, that's it. Let's double our defense budget from $26 billion to $70 billion a year. Let's do that. Like, it's, you know, man, the demands run in excess of the supply.
Okay, first of all, the NATO thing is an obligation we've failed to meet under various prime ministers.
It's not an obligation, Jerry. That's not true.
Okay.
Like, where's the contract?
Coattail on everybody else, which is what we've been doing. And you would be right, Scott, if the prime minister had not promised that by last fall he would have a program in place.
Jerry, there is a program. That's not right. What he said
was...
Yes,
it is.
No, it is not. What he said was we will have a plan for a new infrastructure framework going forward. It's already in place to 2028, actually. The problem is that it's oversubscribed. There's so much demand on a municipal level, and our infrastructure was allowed to crumble for 30 years. And so that's what's going on. So it's not a plan for now. Right? There is funding that's in excess of what was promised in 2015. It's what are we going to do going forward, or how do we meet the excessive demand on the current program?
Okay, he literally made the announcement about a year ago that by fall, which would have been last fall, we will have this program, especially for housing, he was talking about. It didn't happen.
People in British Columbia are being told to no longer describe people who live in British Columbia as British Columbians because that would make Indigenous people feel left out.
They're not.
What?
This is garbage, trolling crap by National Post. They find some report, okay? Now, I admit, it's silly, but they find this thing that's a draft somewhere, then they light it up as a headline story. Get everybody, oh my God, there they are. They're canceling our ability to say this, and they're doing that. This is just like internet trolling stuff. And, you know, there's no suggestion that the British Columbian government is actually going to outlaw the phrase British Columbians. It's all just hyperventilating. Let's put it out on the headline, then put it onto the internet box. Then Jordan Peterson can weigh in and go hysterical, and all the lunatics will, like, thump their feet against the wall. Come on, this
okay,
is just but boring.
It is contained in a guide that was prepared for civil servants.
As a draft, that's unaccepted. And it's like, ooh, let's like be on the hunt for these things all the time so we can always feed the outrage machine.
Scott, they've got a team in British Columbia who is going through, over 100 plus years of legislation and codes to identify gender-specific words to change them. That, unless it's a complete made-up lie, which I guess is possible, that part is true.
Okay. I wish they'd just, I mean, realize it's not a provincial responsibility, but, you know, clean the water, take away the garbage, and let's have it on.
Yeah, don't let the nuts frame the debate would be my response.
Thank you very much, Jerry Agar, Deb Hutton, and Scott Reed on round one.